Hello, you're listening to Parenting Hell with...
James, can you say Rob Beckett?
Rob Beckett.
Can you say Josh Widdicombe?
Josh Widdicombe.
There we go.
Is that North America?
That is the Dublin.
Oh, I'm going to give up this game. I don't think my ears work.
Sending an intro from my son James, who's two. James is a proud big brother to Tom, and your show has gotten me through many night feeds with both babies, as well as a lot of long walks with James when he would only nap in a moving buggy. Oh, those poor parents.
Oh, I used to... Did you ever go out and drive? Have you ever driven a baby around to get to sleep? Yeah. I've done that a few times.
Oh, my God.
Because it gets to the point where, like, no one's sleeping in the house. I just said to Lou, go to sleep. I will happily just drive for an hour with a podcast on. Just drive around the streets of London.
What's your route in that situation?
Well, what's difficult is that what I would do is go down to the M25 and do a couple of junctions because...
Do a lap of London.
Do a fall over the bridge. No, but I'd... on the slow... Because where I live, there's, like, slower roads and loads of traffic lights and then, like, speed bumps. But if you go the other way towards the M25, you can get, like, longer, faster roads. And you can cruise at around 60 on the motorway and then in the slow lane and then the baby will go asleep. Yeah, and then I'd come back and then park on the drive, but then you can... As soon as I turn the engine off...
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Yeah, I've got a driving problem, Rob.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, so... we're going to the southwest this weekend. We're going to Cornwall this weekend.
Lovely. Oh, yeah, because you've got a bit of time off at the moment, haven't you?
Well,
ish.
To give you an idea, 2 weeks in, Friday last week, I've got my 6 weeks off. Obviously, I'm doing stuff like this and doing various things.
Yeah.
Friday of week two was the first day I had to do anything. Admin wise.
So when you say you've got six, basically, when we say we've got 6 weeks off, we're still doing podcasts and stuff, but no big filming or touring.
No. And then there's been two bank holidays, childcare fell through a couple of days, various things have happened leading to Friday.
Yeah, I don't think we should call time off when we're not filming a television show or doing an arena tour because there's still work to be done, isn't there?
There's still work to be done. There's still work to be done. I've got meetings tomorrow, etc. Right. Yeah. Anyway.
Sorry.
So we're going down to Cornwall, and then Blur have got their four warm-up dates in small venues.
Oh, brilliant. Where are they doing them?
Yeah, Colchester, which I can't go to because I'm in Cornwall. And then they're doing Eastbourne on Sunday.
Ooh, lovely.
You're working, right?
Yep, Radio 2.
Yeah, thought so.
Every day. Yeah. I'm working every day in May.
Yeah, yeah.
every day.
So we've got... I was like, well, we're coming back from Cornwall that day. Maybe we could just go to Eastbourne. And then we've got two spare tickets, get people who can drive.
So does Rose want to go?
Yeah.
So you're going to drive back from Cornwall on Sunday?
No, we're getting the train back. We get the train down to Cornwall.
So you get train from Cornwall back to London. How long does that take? No,
Cornwall to Eastbourne, direct. Do you want to know how long it takes?
Is it? Direct?
No, it's not direct. But I mean, we're not going through London.
Okay.
Cornwall to Reading, to Gatwick, to Eastbourne. Hours, 10.
Just drive. You're...
It's six and a half hours.
Are you
drive,
going with
Rob?
The kids?
No.
Oh, you're not. Sorry, you're going away. This has been a terrible story.
It's been the worst start.
You've not been clear enough. I'm not listening.
Exactly. Anyway, long story short, I've got to get a train that's over 8 hours long.
So what you're doing is someone's got on Sunday night, so you're getting the train for 8 hours to Eastbourne. Oh, that'd be fun. Do it.
Do you think? And then I've got to find two people that can drive to help to get us home.
Oh, because you're never going to get a train back.
No. What a life.
So you've got four tickets to Eastbourne and you need someone that will drive you back to East London.
Yeah.
I reckon I could find someone for you.
No, I don't want a stranger.
Well, I'll know him.
No, I don't want someone you know.
My brother Joe would do it.
He's just had a kid.
True. So he's going to be livid now that there's another thing he can't go to.
Yeah, exactly.
The Blur
Tell him I would
gig.
Have taken him.
Yeah, fair enough. Yes, you need to find some friends that can meet you in Eastbourne that are going to drive back.
Yeah.
I think you'll find that. That's a great gig if you've got two spare tickets.
8 hours on a train, it feels a lot.
Who's your favourite one in the band?
Let's not go into it, Rob. Let's not go into it. Am I going for dinner with the drummer beforehand? Let's not go into it. Anyway.
Right, is he in the band?
Yes, it's the original lineup, Rob. They're back together.
Is Damon there?
What?
Your pizza date.
Damon, no, he's doing his vocal warm-ups.
Yeah, of course.
I would love Alex James to be on this show because he's got five kids and one's called Geronimo.
Good cheesemaker.
Good cheesemaker.
He's living his best life.
He is living his best life. I'd advise reading his book if you want to. He spent £1 million on cocaine and champagne in his day.
Who keeps receipts for that? Trying to slip that, yeah, another bag of
not
coke.
I'm saying that's cool. It's not cool. It's not cool. He, for a period,
that's
he was
not
drinking
cool. Go on.
2 bottles of champagne a day.
Oh, bloody hell. God, but his acid reflux was a nightmare.
No, he'd just eat carrots because that was good for his... That would de-acidify it.
Well, basically, I once went to... When I worked for an events company, went to an event at the St Pancras, and we went to the champagne bar, and we got free champagne, and they didn't feed us. All they gave us was these bright green sort of posh olives that I imagine you have from your deli. I drank, I reckon, 3 bottles of champagne and ate about 5 bowls of olives, came home, and I was sick, and it was the frothiest, greenest thing I've ever seen.
Oh, my God.
It was mental. It looked like I'd sucked off the Incredible Hulk.
And the price of that sick. The price of that sick.
The money literally down the drain. And also, that was when I had a Sony version of an iPod, tiny little one, that I dropped into the toilet and was sick on top of.
Oh, no.
It's awful. That was an awful time. Don't drink, kids. Drink's not good.
I'm sure I've told you this. Have I ever told you about when I drank 19 vodka Red Bulls?
That would be bad if it was just Red Bull.
And it wasn't even Red Bull. It was that, because I was a student, it was that fake one called like Red Dragon or whatever it'd be called. You know, it was because it was a quid of vodka Red Bull at Fifth Avenue in Manchester.
Right, okay.
And then I walked home pissed from the bus stop at 3 a.m, went down an alleyway to have a piss. And there was like, I remember there was like an empty beer bottle, transparent bottle. So I ended up, I just aimed and pissed in the bottle, as you would. Bit of fun.
You're a laugh. And then,
I'm a laugh even when I'm on my own.
You don't stop when the cameras stop.
No, exactly. I walked past it the next morning on the way to university, and it was glowing. Like, the colour of it.
It was still there, full of piss.
It was still there, and it was, like, a luminous yellow. Like, I've never seen a colour before.
No, 19's pretty good going, Josh.
I was back in the day, Rob, when I didn't used to get hangovers. I used to be able to do what I wanted. Here I am now.
Oh, dear. I remember I used to work at 6:30 a.m. at a supermarket when I was down in Canterbury studying, and because it was a student town, the amount of you could see all the sick on the floor where people just been sick walking home. This is a horrible intro. What are we doing?
Omid Jalili, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Omid Jalili. Apologise, Omid, if you have listened to this intro, that it wasn't ideal, but you did a great job as a guest.
Yeah.
So everyone enjoy this rather than what's just happened.
Right, here's Omid Jalili. Welcome to the podcast, Omid Jalili.
Very excited. Omid, children, talk to me. How many have you got? How old are they?
I have 3 children and they are all in their 20s.
All grown up.
Yeah, they're older now.
Does that feel like is out the woods is the right word to use? Do you feel like each day you're still a parent? You know, is it playing on your mind as much as it did?
He's out the woods. He started a logging company. It's deforestation that's going on there.
That's a very good question. You know, most comics, when you have children, and I became like a paid comic when my first child's daughter, when she was about 2.5, around 1997, 98. Ooh. And then I had 2 more kids. So I had 3 kids by 2000. So I was doing jonglers. I was doing all those gigs. And comics usually talk about their children. Like, as you grow with that comic, they talk about my children now 3, 4. And then you realize comics do it because their children are tax deductible commodities. And we're happy to do that because it saves us some money, because it's part of our, you know, part of our job and our material. But it is very difficult. I think we should talk about that, because how old are your kids? Now your kids are...
5 and 7.
Okay, so 5 and 7, Rob and Josh?
2 and 5.
Okay, all right. So look, this is when I was starting out, it's very, very difficult. And I had so many experiences of coming home late, waking up early.
Yeah.
And actually, that's not good for you. I mean, I remember there was a journey. I came back from Liverpool and I had to be home, had to drive home from Liverpool, because there was something I had to do at the school and I had to pick up my kid. You know, it's always, so I'm driving back. And you know that bit of the M6, there are no lights. And around Wolverhampton, there are lots of lights.
Yeah.
On the M6. And I was so tired. I was hallucinating. I felt the reflections from the lights. It looked like there were pterodactyls flying at me. So As I'm driving along, I'm slapping myself to keep myself awake and kind of going, slap. And then I saw this pterodactyl and I ducked. I ducked a few times. I just started ducking. And then this blue light came on and the police took me to one side. They said, sir, do you know how fast you were going? I said, look, I'm a comic. I'm trying to get home. I'm tired. Was I going 90, 100? He goes, no, you were doing 10 miles an hour in the middle lane.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. This is like midnight.
And he goes, we were next to you driving for about 30 seconds. And I could see it. It was only when you ducked. It must be. I suddenly ducked. I said, did you see the pterodactyls as well? And they said, breathalyze him. So they breathalyzed me. And then they said, you're just tired. And actually, to give the police credit, they said, follow us. We're going to take you to a service station. We want you to sleep.
Yeah.
Just sleep. And then I slept. And unfortunately, I slept till six. And I missed the thing. And everyone was upset with me. But actually, you realize to be a dad, to have a family, and if you're going to have a family, you want to be a good dad, you want to raise your kids well, it is really taxing on the body. So I remember I actually developed this problem called sleep apnea where I have to sleep with a sleep machine, and you have a mask on, and of course the kids would think it was funny. So my young son, age five, would come in as I'm waking up and he'd lift the mask off my face, and of course the machine goes into overdrive. You go and goes like that, and he goes, let's go. He goes, hits my face. I go, ah! And I look back and I just see the leg of a child running away. You know, and I think that you never got any sleep. That was the one thing. And that's, I started getting acid reflux because I was sleeping. And then I remember once coming home, then I got home 2 or 3 in the morning and I ordered a pizza and I watched television with a pizza. And my daughter came down at age 7, woke me up at 6:30 and said, you're a disgrace, because I'd fallen asleep in my clothes. And I think BBC Two was raging. There was something I was watching and I had like pizza all over my beard. I remember she just learned the word. She goes, you're a disgrace. And I said, how did you learn the word disgrace? Who taught you? Did your mum teach you that? Who taught you the word disgrace? So one thing people don't get is actually it is physically taxing. But I'm very proud that actually if you put the time in, my kids in their 20s and they're all actually doing quite well. And I like all three of them now. So actually it is a balance in life. Life is always a balance about your quality of life, your career, your family life. And if one of them drops, all three of them drop.
Yeah.
So I'm very proud and happy that I did spend a bit of time with my kids because I actually like them. I actually like my kids.
That's the weird thing. In their 20s, you're both adults, right? Yeah. It's quite a good way of putting I like them is because obviously you then have a relationship with them where they're on a kind of level with you. You're not like, oh, they're a five-year-old or, oh, they're going through the teenage years or, oh, they're, you know, dealing with this. It's like these people are grown-ups.
Yes.
Would I be friends with these people?
And they're going to overtake us and be in charge of us.
They're much better. They're already way, way ahead of us. And I have to tell you that on the one hand, I have a daughter and two boys, and the two boys are now, as they were growing up, I'm showing them pictures of myself when I was their age. And they look exactly like me. I mean, it's unbelievable. I used to have hair and I used to be thinner. And so they look at me and they're thinking, wow, if we looked like this guy when he was like 19, 20, I said, yeah, this is what you're going to look like. And they are so horrified. So when they used to come home and I'd be sat in my pants watching telly with my legs up, and they'd come in, they goes, what are you doing? I said, I'm being you in 30 years time. This is you. And they are so horrified that they are going to look like me. So we have that relationship. But another thing I will say, as they're all adults now, and I listen to them because they have opinions on stand-up comedy. They have opinions on, like once we're in the car, we just come back from, driving back from the Auburn Arena, the St. Albans, they've come, the whole family come to see me. And nobody said a word. It was a great show and it was standing ovation. I said, there's no one going to say anything. We got to the outskirts of London. I said, we've been driving for half an hour. No one said a word. Are you going to say something? And I think my middle son, who was about 16 at the time, he said...
mind out for that pterodactyl.
I ducked a few times.
Anyone going to say anything? Why does Dad keep ducking? Sorry.
I don't know. Why did anyone sing it?
Speed up. You're going 10 miles an hour on the M25.
But they said to me... they said, you know, you do a few bits that we don't particularly like and it's a bit filthy and it's a bit... And I said, is that a problem? And they said, well, and this is very interesting, because put it this way, if you go to a Michelin star restaurant, which they had been with me a few times, that's one thing I wish I hadn't spoiled them. They said, if you go to a Michelin star restaurant, they bring you a wonderful meal, but there's a little bit of shit on the side of the plate. Would you eat that food? I went, no, I'd take it back, clean it off. or give me a new plate. They goes, well, that's how we feel about your stand-up. It's a lovely meal. They're little bits of shit. It just ruined the whole thing. And I went,
oh my God, that would destroy me.
It did destroy me. It destroyed me because it actually made me realize that in comedy, this is why we can do gigs and we're having a wonderful time. And as comics, everyone's laughing, but we always hone in on the one person not enjoying it. Or have you had a show where you're loving a show, then you do one joke and a couple of people get up and leave?
I've never had that, Ahmed. I've never had that. How dare you?
You've never had that. Okay, well, you're not a proper comic then.
I know. I'm getting flashbacks of Edinburgh. That was horrible.
Yeah.
So you realize actually comedy in general, what you learn, we can't please all the people all the time, and people have a right to be offended. But the fact that even my own children were saying, you could be so good, but you're not. And we won't bring our friends to see you, and we're not really proud of you, and you just look like...
Oh, no. What?
How old were they at this point?
They're in their mid-teens. They're old enough.
Oh, that's to... never ask a teenager for a feedback.
But do you know what? I brought it up with them now, and they stand by their comments. Do they? It's interesting.
So was it the in general your stuff, or was it more that like... And I wanted to speak about this as well. It was like, as you get older, you know, everyone's views and stuff get a bit dated because that's just what, like, you know, you don't experience new things with the younger generation. A way more woke and across social change.
Yes.
Would it be things like that where you might use a turn of phrase that is fine, but actually a little bit, that's not what you use anymore? Or was it just the material and the performance in general? Because yes. I think that's what your kids can help you with.
And they do, yeah. Actually, that's a very good point. That as they got older, they're very aware of not just woke culture, but even things that you've missed somehow. So in that sense, they were right. So I dropped the joke and they often come and watch. And they give the odd tip like that, which I think is very, very helpful. But in general, it's interesting because they say, look, the dad we see at home is so funny, but the dad we see on stage is very different. It's like you're trying to please people and you're trying to be a Middle Eastern bloke in white society.
Yeah.
And there's a part of us, we're not comfortable with that. So we wish you could be more like the way you were at home. I think that's the thing. That's what pleased me. They thought I was much funnier off stage than on. And I said, well, it is an act. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
Doing stand-up is an act. It's what you choose to put out. But they said, yeah, we're just not comfortable with it. So we hope, Dad, when they're 14, a child goes, we hope, Dad, you find your inner authenticity and that can be shown one day. That's the kind of thing they say. But at the same time, you see, I was very lucky that I got to work with someone of the caliber of Whoopi Goldberg, who then one day just turned around to me and just said, you know, you must never stop doing stand-up. I said, why? Because you're the first person from your background doing it. You're like the Richard Pryor of brown people. And I said, what are you talking about? She goes, yeah, but you're also 30 years behind where the black community is. We had Richard Pryor, we had Eddie Murphy, we had a bunch of people who, I suppose, were trailblazers and started something off. In a sense, you're the same. So actually, you should take comedy very seriously because it's very responsible. So actually also watch your material because people are watching it very carefully. And then when I told my kids that, they went, yes, yes, that's the thing. That's what you don't get. I don't think you get how important you are for your region of people, because there had been very few people. And I'll tell you a funny story. And we can mention his name because he doesn't mind me mentioning him. Do you know, anyone know Smashy from Southend? Do you know Smashy? We used to run these comedy clubs.
No.
Smashy in the 90s used to run Churchill's in Southend, and he had a couple of comedy clubs. And he'd seen me in 1996, and he goes, you, mark my office now, we'll talk to you. And it was proper Southend. He goes, do you know what thing is? You're great, you are. But your name, Majajaja, I can't remember that. What you need to do, get yourself a photo shoot, get yourself a turban, pantaloons, and curly-toed shoes. Call yourself Ali Baba, the Sultan of Comedy. You get a lot of work, son. And I said, well, I'm...
Oh, my word.
And I started talking about... Well, I'm actually very inspired by a film called My Beautiful Laundrette, which was written by Hanif Qureshi, who was... And he never changed his name, so I'd like to keep the name so people learn my name. He goes, nah, mate, nah, nah, definitely Ali Baba. And then I met him 10 years later. He was walking past the BBC, and I was about to shoot the Ahmed Jalili show. And he goes, hello, Ahmed, what are you doing here? I said, I'm doing a show. He goes, what's the show? I said, well, it's actually called the Ahmed Jalili Show, and it's a primetime BBC One show. He goes, did you use the picture of yourself as Ali Baba, the Sultan of Comedy? I said, no, I didn't. He goes, you'd have got here 5 years earlier, mate. 5 years earlier. He's still stuck to that yeah. particular narrative.
Do you think, though, because of the pressures of having kids, where when you broke through and there was an opportunity to talk about the stuff you wanted to talk about rather than sort of just getting, you know, booked on stuff and making that sort of demographic laugh, do you think that, like, maybe if you didn't have the kids and that pressure to provide, you may have been able to take a bit more, like, chances with what you was putting out?
That's a really good question. I think the whole aspect of wanting to provide is very powerful for comics, because soon you realise you're doing all these terrible pub gigs and someone sticking a tenner in your hand saying, well, that's the, you know, that's the door split. And you think, well, who are those guys making a lot of money? And then you've got Dominic Holland doing brilliant jokes like, they say kids change your life. In my case, they ruined it. And it gets a big laugh and you think, oh, okay, so...
Tell you what, that didn't work out for him as it did, though, did it?
Because that's so funny, isn't it?
It turned out his son's actually set him up for life.
Set him up completely for life. So that joke has come back to bite him in the arse.
That's so funny.
It's such a funny thing, isn't it? If people don't know, his son is Tom Holland, who's Spider-Man. It's unbelievable the way that's worked out.
Yeah.
So you start realising... actually having kids is what drives you, and you think, okay, I've got to get funnier, I've got to get better so I can start providing. So actually I'm very grateful that I had kids early on in my stand-up career, because it was always about, you know, we're doing this for the love of it, we're doing it because we love laughs and we're pretty damaged individuals and we need the laughter of strangers to validate our very existence in life. But actually the kids did help focus and did help you have more of a plan and make decisions about what's the right show to do and what's the wrong show.
I'm just really interested, because obviously we're talking about this in a comedy sense, but were your parents, I don't know when they came over, but you're from Iranian background, right? So
yes.
What was your house like growing up? Was it just for me and the listeners? Are you first generation?
Yes. Yeah, I've got a brother in his mid-60s. They came in 58.
And so how did their parenting differ from your parenting? Because that's like the hugely different kind of cultures you've grown up in, presumably.
Yeah, it's very difficult to talk about one particular culture, because I'm a British-Iranian, parents are Iranian, so I'm already, you know, a bit of a minority. British-Iranian. Then even within the Iranian community, I'm not a Muslim, I'm a Baha'i. And the Baha'i faith is very different from the way Muslims are. So I'm actually a minority within a minority. And even within the Baha'i community, my parents have seen it as a bit weird. So I'm actually a minority within a minority within a minority. So
you're a hipster.
I'm a real hipster.
Why were your parents seen as a bit weird?
Because we had this guest house and we lived in a block of flats, which was a big six-bedroom flat, which then after the Iranian Revolution of 1979, a lot of Iranians used to come over to get medical help. And they would come and stay with us because it was more homely and it was cheap. So I was raised in a guest house where there was no differentiation between the work life and the family life. So we were all just together. So the house was filled with Iranian men and women walking around in pajamas. The radio's on, the telly's on. Food was a buffet on all the time. It was like a kind of party, but a conference. There's always like 15, 16 people in the house.
Wow.
And I saw my father using humor. He kept saying, what you've got to do is make them laugh, because if they laugh more, it has a palliative effect and they feel better and then they get better and they leave and we get more clients. So he'd always like, how would you like your eggs are also another word for balls. So for bollocks, he would say, how would you like your bollocks fried, scrambled or fondled? It was always jokes like that. And everyone was laughing. So I learned very early on that actually that upbringing was perfect for stand-up comedy, because you're always talking to people, you're always hearing stories, and you realize storytelling is the most powerful thing, especially with a punchline or especially with something funny. And even my parents used to make up jokes. I remember my mother, I said, why is that funny? And she'd teach joke construction. She goes, you see, the way a joke works, Ahmed, is that you do a setup of something that's relatable to people. And then you tell the story. And at the end, there's something surprising they wouldn't expect. And I was like 10, 11 being trained. She was basically training me. So when you take over the business, you've got to write your own jokes to keep with the idea of making people feel better. So they leave and you get a bigger turnaround of people coming around.
Right. So you'd be like, take on the company and the job and be the funny guy welcoming all these people so they keep coming back. Yeah.
To be sociable and to be funny. Then I realized actually my brother didn't want to do that. My sister didn't want to do it. And I was damned if I was going to do it.
Yeah.
But then I went to, my wife actually took me to the Comedy Store in 1994.
So what did you do before comedy, Ahmed? What was your...
Well, I was a struggling actor and I was doing, you know, we lived in the former Czechoslovakia as well between 1990 and 95. So I was doing experimental theatre for about 5 years. So crazy. And then we had children. We came back. My mother got cancer and she died. So we had to come back and look after my dad. So it was about quickly learning this tool of stand-up comedy, because you could probably do this. It's probably the only time a partner has suggested. Partners hate their partners being stand-up comedians. It's like such a terrible job for, it's you feel so insecure. But I was actually encouraged to do it. And I used all those skills from the home life.
And how different was your children's upbringing then from your upbringing? Was it vastly different, or what did you take from your parents' kind of upbringing when you were bringing up your kids?
Oh, completely. Well, the first thing, I didn't let lots of people stay in the house because I didn't feel, I felt we should have a very private life, and they all had a proper education, whereas mine was a bit haphazard. And I was very much, because I was the youngest child in that milieu of people, I was left alone to my own devices. I often said to my parents, you just let me, you're quite strict with my brother and sister, but with me, they said, oh, we just gave up. We don't really understand British. Just let go. I used to come home at 6 a.m. I used to nick my dad's car when I was 15 and drive around London. And all he'd say is, if you're going to nick the car, could you put it back in the same place? Because I don't want to walk around like a twat for half an hour looking for it. So they kind of understood that I should be left alone.
So very laid back.
With me, extremely laid back. And I never forget on her deathbed, my mum just had said, you're a very easy child. And, you know, we just trusted you all right. And we left you to God. And I'm so glad that you've got a career now. And as long as you're not upset with me. I said, no. It was like wonderful to do what I liked, because I probably should have disciplined you more, but I just trusted you and it was all fine. So it's a very lax kind of upbringing, when in fact the Baha'i community is very strong on upbringing and children and education of children. But for some reason, I think they just were so beaten down by all these people, they didn't bother with me. But it was very different. So my kids' upbringing was very controlled, make sure they're always dressed well. I mean, once I remember my parents had a note saying, we've noticed Omid has been wearing the same clothes for the whole academic year. Does he have any other clothes? Because I used to come in, I just like this blue polo neck top. And the teacher said, you've worn that every day for the first 2 terms. I said, I like it. So they sent my parents things. Does he actually wash? Does he, you know? Because I don't think I bothered. I didn't brush my teeth or anything. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, I didn't do anything. And then my parents felt so ashamed because we'd just taken our eye off the ball. We're so sorry. Then I started having to brush my teeth when I was 9. And I started wearing different clothes. I thought I could wear the same clothes. What are you doing?
You're like Steve Jobs. You're ahead of time.
I probably was.
You know, Steve Jobs wore the same outfit every day. You were that guy.
Yes, exactly.
And are you quite strict with your kids now then, Omid? Were you strict with them with schooling and stuff like that? If they'd nicked your car and driven it around London.
Oh, there's no way that would have happened.
Yeah.
I was very lucky. There was a bit like good cop, bad cop. Raising my wife was really strong with the kids, and I was there, but you know, also as a comic, you're away a lot of the time. So
how much were you away for then? Because your career was really like hitting off and getting mega, and like mega films, stuff you just cannot say no to.
Yes,
they must have been at a like young age where that's when you want to spend time with them the most. Did you find yourself away a lot then?
Yes, there was one year I wasn't there at all. I did the sitcom with Whoopi Goldberg in New York, and they stayed in London because they didn't want to take the kids out of school. And then I did 3 films on the trot. So about 1 year and 4 months.
Wow.
I was pretty much away, coming home the odd weekend.
And what was that like?
Not good at all. I don't think it's good for family life. I think the most important thing is that you're there for your kids, and you spend time with them.
How did you stay in touch with them in those days? Because obviously there's no FaceTime.
There's no FaceTime.
Like, how does it work?
The odd phone call. Phone call once every few days. Here's Daddy on the phone. But it was like, Daddy on the phone's not that important, so it wasn't really like, hello, everyone good?
And it disrupts the family dynamic and all the schedule.
So I just used to come home and try and spend 3 or 4 days at home, and just so they didn't forget me. So I think I just about got away with it, but they still seemed to like me and still seemed to listen to me. But no, it's not good.
How did you overcompensate? How was you overcompensating? Would you be like trying to do like mad toy shop trips and days out and then go off again for a few months? Or were you trying a bit too hard?
Yeah, just lots of dancing. I play some music and I come and dance in my pants for them and just do stupid. They'd be laughing their heads off. I try to be the entertaining dad.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't hate me kind of thing. So they did think I was very funny. Yeah. But also I did try and get involved. I remember Rob Brydon, he had his kids at the same school. So we were both very, very busy. And we often, I talk about it, we drop our kids off and go for a walk and a coffee and say we need to spend time more with our kids. And they're like, sports day, we've got to be there at sports day.
Yeah.
And my kids were so embarrassed because there was the father's race. And I was doing joke kind of like groin stretches and things, but we were clearly the least fit. So as 20 dads ran off, I just looked at him. I said, we can steal this. So as he ran ahead of me and I just rugby tackled him. And then we just were fighting. Every time I got up, he'd pull me back. And he'd get up, I'd pull him back. And it all became about us. And all the other parents were just saying, my kids are so embarrassing. You're supposed to be here for us, but you made it all about you. And I said, yeah, but was it funny? It was funny, though, wasn't it? Oh, it was funny.
So you're a good footballer, though, aren't you, Omid?
Yes, I've just retired from playing football. I've just put out a little video.
Oh.
So I've stopped playing, but I did enjoy, I think football was also, I will say to anyone who's raising kids, playing Sunday football was the one thing I appreciated, where I just switched off from everything. And for 9 minutes, I thought of literally nothing but football, and that's very healthy. So if you have any kind of sport thing you do as a parent, I really, really recommend it.
Yeah, it's that exercise every week and you can switch off and stuff. Yeah, Did your kids get into football? You're a big Chelsea fan. Did you take them? And is that a bond you've still got? Because a lot of people say that going to football is a good family connection that you can do as they get older.
Yeah, especially with my middle child. My middle child, he played football and he was a big Chelsea fan, and we were season ticket holders. I go with him when I can. My middle child was probably the more talented footballer, and then he kept scoring these worldies in the last minute for his school football team, and they got to what's called the ESFA Cup final, which is the English schools final, and they won it. It was a game at Reading, and the winning goal was scored with an overhead kick. And then my son, age 16, suddenly announced his retirement. He goes, I'm announcing my retirement. I said, what are you talking about? You're a school football. He goes, no, I've achieved everything I want now, and I'm not going to do that. I'm going to retire. And he's actually retired.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, he's kicked the ball about 3 or 4 times. He's still got it, but he just doesn't want to play.
Wow.
He was also embarrassed because I got so into his career and I was screaming.
Oh, were you? Were you one of those touchline dads?
Yeah, I'm afraid the whole discussion started because of me, something I did with my...
What did you do?
Oh, God, this was... You should never do this. This is really not good. And he was playing in a league, and we live in East Sheen, and my son was playing for Barnes next to it, and Barnes were playing East Sheen. It's a big local derby. And they had this American woman who was the manager, very nice woman, but she never really trained them. She just said, okay, we're running at halftime. Let's get those oranges around and let's switch it up. Let's bring on substitutes. And they were a good team, but they never got team talk. So they'd always get beat, but they were quite good. And so for the big game, I said to my son, look, do you want me to give a team talk? He goes, I don't think that's not right. She's a woman. It's not right for your dad. Yeah. I said, well, you give me the sign. You give me a sign and I'll say it. So they're losing 2-0 at halftime. And she goes, okay, everyone, let's file in. Let's get those oranges out. And he looked at me like that and he went, do it.
Oh.
I said, excuse me, do you mind if I have a quick word with the lads? She goes, yeah, sure. Go ahead. I said, right, lads, Gussie, come in here. I said, Gussie, you've got to get in hard from the kickoff. Get the ball out to Sam. Sam's quick. You flood the area. And I said to my son, I said, you got to let him know you're there. He's getting past you. So let him know you're there. Be strong in the first tackle. So they kicked off, score immediately, because they're losing 2-1. I was going, come on, lads, let's get one more. Kick off again, immediately get the ball, score a second goal. I said, you can't do this. You come on. And people said, could you calm down? I said, they're going to win this. They're going to win this. And then there was the slide tackle went in, and my son takes this boy out. And he doesn't get up. And I said, nice one, show me you're there, like that. And the kid doesn't get up. And the referee is looking back at me. And his parent says, he's broken his leg. Are you happy now? And I said, what's going on? And my son's crying, everyone's crying. And I said, what's happening here? Because he's broken his leg, like that. So I just walked away. So I'm walking away, and there's an ambulance coming on the field, and my wife's coming back. She goes, what's going on? I said, just turn back and walk. Just don't say a word.
No.
We went back. I got banned. I got banned from coming because apparently I was inciting violence. God. I didn't know. They were like, so he was on the side saying, get in hard.
No, but you didn't know that he'd hurt his leg when you said, good tackle.
And it was maybe overdid it. Yeah. I was showing passion and enthusiasm, which is what was missing. And it actually got the players fired up. And they still say it was the best team talk they've ever had. I'm very happy. I'm very happy about that.
Yeah.
And at least your son said it was okay to do the team talk. I thought you were going to say, he said no, but you just bowled in and did the team talk. But
I would have done it anyway.
I think, you know, obviously it's terrible that boy hurt his leg and stuff like that. But, I played football, the comedian's football. I rolled my ankle and got tackled by Andy Zaltzman. And it was a strong tackle. It wasn't an unfair tackle. And I snapped all my ligaments and was in a cast for like 6 months. So it does happen at football.
Yeah. When you're playing with someone as tough and rough and tumble as Andy Zaltzman, it's difficult, isn't it, Rob?
Ha ha ha!
let's talk to you about your podcast. Please tell me a story, which is a great concept. I wasn't aware of this.
Yes.
This is a great concept, Dominic. So, well, it's better if you explain the concept than me because it's your podcast. It'd be very rude to get you on, interview you and not let you talk about your podcast. Tell us how this works.
Well, the way it works, it's about the evolution of storytelling. So someone tells a story, which you tell to one comic who then if I tell a story to you, then yeah. I'll leave. Then you tell the story to Rob.
Yeah.
Then you leave. Then Rob will tell the story to Ivor Dambina. Then Rob leaves. And at the end, after five goes, the last person tells a story back to me. So if you tell a story, like we all know as comics, start off with something good, good middle bit, interesting, and a great ending to a story. So you'd think that's why we're comedians.
Yeah.
I'm sure, Rob, if I told you a joke now, you'd listen to it, you'd laugh, and then you could probably tell that joke back because you would understand what the joke is. Mm. A lot of people, even when you're telling the story, they do this. They're looking at you, and then their eyes just look to one side. You don't know, they're thinking about dinner that night or something. For a moment, they've lost concentration.
Yeah. I've done enough podcasts with Rob. We both know the look in each other's eyes.
Exactly. I never listen to anything more than when someone's telling me a joke. And in fact, I'm very lucky that because I've done that radio show, I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue, I'm on what used to be called the phone list, where Barry Cryer would ring you up and just tell a joke because he believed that joke telling was very important. And he goes, comedy keeps your brain sharp, it keeps your heart young, and we've got to keep telling jokes to each other. And these guys in their 80s are still telling jokes. So I get Barry Cryer ring me up and I'd listen intently and I could tell that joke back straight away to someone. And I think that's the process they have for comics. So, but here, when you're working with comics who maybe are a bit self-obsessed or comics who are worried about their own story.
That's all of them, isn't it?
All of them. But it is amazing where you'd think comics would tell a story back. I told a story when I told it back, it was unrecognizable. And I was so disappointed, but they had added some extra funny things in there. So there was a guy in the first series, Kai Samra. I talked about my uncle Ezzat. And then I think the next one down, he goes, his uncle Dave. This Iranian name just became Dave. So it's amazing how information gets lost. So the podcast is about fake news. It's about embellishments. It's about what is entertaining. Can you make an entertaining story better? Usually not. But the really good stories you find come back to you shaved down.
Yeah.
But there were some stories which are just very complicated, came back as completely different. So it is actually a very interesting and fascinating look at the way stories get filtered down.
And is each episode a different telling of the story or they're all in one?
No. Each series is one person telling a story and then you hear everyone telling that same story. And it is absolutely fascinating because people listen to it and go, no, missed out the most important bit. You know, people shouting. So it's actually teaching people about storytelling, which I think is fascinating.
Brilliant.
Please tell me a story.
Yes.
And we should say this is available on all good podcast outlets, such as Spotify. Do your children listen to the podcast, Omid?
No. Actually, my youngest did.
Yeah.
He listened to the very first one, and he thought it was really funny.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
He goes, I'll tell you what, it is really, because it's very chaotic. And the second series, there was a review saying it's brilliantly and gloriously chaotic because we're all shouting at each other. Because at the end, we come back and talk about what happened. And that is the most chaotic bit of podcasting. We have six comics arguing about who said what.
Oh, God.
And where it all broke down.
Of any of your children, because obviously you're so passionate about storytelling, jokes, comedy, and this has come from your parents, you know, arguably they've instilled that in you. Have any of your children taken this on with them, like in their careers?
Well, one thing I will say, storytelling is a big part of their lives. And they always say, oh, we really miss you reading Asterix books to us. Because I would do all the voices. But actually they've all gone into, like my middle son who loved Asterix, he's now a film director, he's 27. I have my daughter who's 30 now. She's a film editor. She edits films. And my youngest son is a musician and an actor. So they've all gone into the business in one sense because of their love of it. And they're all at the beginning of their careers. So, yes, I think they're doing all right, yeah.
That's exciting. Oh,
that must be so exciting.
It is exciting because we do have differences of opinions, but we share the same love and passion for it.
It's what your parents wanted to do, but you've done it in the entertainment world rather than the guest house world.
And it's not just that. I now realise that on my father's side, they were all travelling poets. They were all poets the turn of the 20th century, between 1899 and 1910. They're a group of poets. It'd be like five comics going on the road.
Yeah.
And just literally pitching up somewhere. They put a tent out. They give out a couple of leaflets. There'll be a performance here of just poetry and comedy and storytelling. So that's what they used to do. And it was my great-great-great-grandfather used to do that. So it's in the blood as well.
Oh, wow.
Do you know what? Your podcast all comes around to tie up at the end, and you've done it for us here, Omid. We always end with the same question.
Last question, Omid. It's basically, so what is the one thing that your partner does, parenting-wise, that does or used to drive you mad? And if they listened back, they'd go, yeah, fair enough, actually, he's got a point. And then what is the one thing she does where you go, she's so amazing and incredible, I'm so lucky to have children with her? You can answer them in whichever order you choose.
Well, I take the last question first because it was the eternal patience where you just want to grab a kid and say, are you fucking kidding me? When are you going to do this? And she was always very loving and like, I understand why you do this, but, you know, we don't really do that. And it was just the eternal patience where I was never patient.
Yeah.
I just used to, and I don't think it's right. I used to scream and shout and get pissed off and say things because you always feel I'm thick-skinned and I'm a comic and I deal with truth and honesty straight away. But I don't think with little children you should do that.
Oh, mate, that was brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Podcast is called Please Tell Me a Story and it's available everywhere. Thank you. Omid Jalili.
Cheers, Omid.
Thank you, guys.
Omid Jalili.
There we go.
I love him. Such a good bloke.
Lovely bloke. If I do sports day, I'm keeping my head down. I'm not making a scene, Rob.
That was mad. But I do think that's an older comic generation thing like that. The mad naughties of just like, yeah, let's go and do that. Well, I'll just... Yeah. I don't know.
Whereas me and you are like, I'm going to turn up to sports day and I don't want anyone to reference that I'm a comedian at any point. I'm just going to keep my head down. Thank you very much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know if I could do that. That would be remarkable.
If someone punched me at sports day, I'd just leave. If someone rugby tackled me.
If you're listening, anyone that's kids go to Josh's school, smack him and he'll go home.
And now I've got fucking grass stains on my jeans. Thank you very much.
Right. See you Tuesday, Josh.
See you Tuesday. Bye.
Politics.
Sport.
Climate change.
Culture wars.
I'm Jack D.
And I'm Sean Walsh.
These are just some of the things we won't be talking about in our podcast, Oh My Dog.
Not that we couldn't if we wanted to.
Oh, of course we could.
Obviously, we're both well known for our scathing satire and social commentary, but we've decided to set that aside to talk about our favourite subject.
Dogs. Do you let your dogs kiss you on the face?
Tiggy and Molly will nibble your earlobe.
Oh, Jack likes that.
Jack likes that.
I mean, from Dolly. Sorry, that sounded like Jack likes me doing that.
Old French bulldog, Professor Snowball. If he can't see us in the house, you'll hear this horrible noise. There was once when Jane and I, we locked the bedroom door, we thought there was a man in the house, as we heard him shout, no!
Give me one sec. Grace? Is Mildred chipped? Oh, yeah, no, of course she is. No, she is chipped. Sorry.
Actually, it'd be good if Grace could do the programme because seems to know more about what's going on.
Join us on our podcast, Oh My Dog.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram at OMDpod.